Welcome back everyone to the Damage Report. I'm John Adirola and I'm fairly heavily caffeinated, so let's get into the news. No, we have a lot to talk about today though. Obviously there's the new both threatened breaking the law news and actually breaking the law news, both of them centered around Rudy Giuliani. So that's gonna be exciting first off story. But a little bit later on, Bernie Sanders has talked a little bit more about his health and the nature of his campaign. And he's not happy with some of the ways it's being portrayed. I'm gonna add an extra terrible way it's being portrayed a little bit later on. And Trump on the Kurds, someone tried to teach him history and it didn't go well. Plus PragerU, what's up with that? Parker Malloy of Media Matters is gonna join us and break it down. And right-wing media has apparently decided that if you can't take out AOC based on her ideas, talk about her hair. And so that's gonna be a weird way to end the show, but unfortunately we've been forced into it. So with that, why don't we jump into the big legal news of the day. It's never good for Rudy Giuliani when he's in the news, and he has been a couple of times over just the last 24 hours involving both his actual connections to people who have now gone down for legal charges for almost exactly what this impeachment inquiry is about. And the revelation that up to about 2 years ago, there were further attempts to do almost the exact same thing. Donald Trump trying to break the law and being stopped at the last moment. So we're gonna start with that, and then we're gonna move into Rudy Giuliani's associates who have now been arrested. So let's start with Trump. Trump was apparently, he had apparently back in 2017 pressed then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to persuade the Justice Department to drop a criminal case against an Iranian Turkish gold trader who was a client of Rudy Giuliani, according to three people familiar with the 2017 meeting in the Oval Office. So a couple interesting things about that. First of all, Rex Tillerson has previously said that Donald Trump tried to get him to do things that Rex then had to say that would be breaking the law. But so far as I know, he hasn't given many examples of that. This is an example of that. The other thing that's interesting is that this is like the ultimate 2019 politics Mad Libs. You've got Trump, Rex Tillerson, the Iranians, the Turks, traitors, we have a traitor in the Oval Office, and Rudy Giuliani, all getting wrapped into one story. So Rudy Giuliani was working not only with Donald Trump, but also as the private lawyer of other people, including this individual, this Iranian Turkish gold trader who was being investigated for breaking the law, which we'll get into. And Trump tried to use the US State Department to pressure that investigation to be shut down. So you have corruption that's being investigated and Trump tries to shut down the investigation into that corruption. That's weird, I'm sure that won't turn into a gigantic story in a couple of years. It's the thing like, we've always said that the right exercises projection. They say that the left is doing what they're actually doing. But now even in terms of the crimes, it's all projection down to the individual countries involved in it. So Tillerson didn't do it, by the way, importantly. He refused, arguing that it would constitute interference in an ongoing investigation of the traitor. This is Reza Zarab, according to the people who talked to Bloomberg about this story. They said other participants in the Oval Office were shocked by the request. Quick note, if you're in these meetings, stop being shocked and horrified by them and start actually doing something. Don't wait 2 years to reveal what you were so shocked and aghast at. Actually stop it then, reveal it then. Just a little request for people currently operating the Oval Office. But let's continue. Tillerson immediately repeated his objections to then Chief of Staff John Kelly in a hallway conversation just outside the Oval Office, emphasizing that the request would be illegal. Okay, so who is this individual? Why was Trump trying to get the State Department to shut down the investigation? So Zarab was being prosecuted in federal court in New York at the time on charges of evading US sanctions against Iran's nuclear program. Again, this could not be the more perfect investigation for them to try to shut down. Let's see, he had hired former Attorney General Michael Mukasey and Giuliani, who has said he reached out repeatedly to US officials to seek a diplomatic solution for his client outside the courts. Zarab's release was a high priority for Turkish President Erdogan until the gold trader agreed to cooperate with prosecutors in New York. So again, we've now wrapped in sanctions against Iran over their nuclear program. We've now got Erdogan involved in this. It's just everything all in one. It's like the perfect parfait. You know, you combine unlike things into something that's delicious in its entirety. So Zarab later pled guilty to the investigation that they were trying to shut down and testified against Mehmet Hakan Atilla, who was eventually convicted of helping Iran evade economic sanctions on literally billions of dollars of oil revenue and served 28 months in US prison before returning to Turkey in July to a hero's welcome. Turkey has so far managed to avoid US penalties over the sanctions evasion scheme. So this guy was living in Turkey, helping Iran to evade sanctions on oil revenue, which was obviously economically beneficial to Turkey. It was benefiting them too. He was benefiting personally, it was benefiting Turkey. Trump tried to stop the investigation into one of his associates. And somehow the fact that even though the individuals went down legally for what they did, there's been nothing bad that's happened to Erdogan or Turkey. Weird how that works out. So Donald Trump, who tried to get involved, also hasn't had any sort of consequences for it. So anyway, in terms of Giuliani and how this might hurt him, after all, this was his client. It's ostensibly the only reason that Trump would be trying to get involved is either personal loyalty to Rudy Giuliani, one of his closest associates over the past few years, or potentially involvement for the benefit of Erdogan, since Trump, of course, has real estate dealings, already had them at that point in Istanbul. In a phone interview this month, Giuliani initially denied that he'd ever raised Zarab's case with Trump, but later said he might have done so. So we find out now that he definitely did so. But he tried to evade any sort of consequences for that in the short term. But that's not the only thing that involves Rudy Giuliani in sort of internal corruption to the White House right now. We found out this morning that two Soviet-born businessmen with ties to Rudy Giuliani were arrested Wednesday on federal charges of violating campaign finance laws through a six-figure donation they facilitated to President Donald Trump's official super PAC. Parnas and Fruman, these are the two individuals, are charged with making illegal straw donations, including a $325,000 contribution to the group America First Action. So as you'll see, this also will involve Ukraine, because of course it has to. And so these two Soviet-born businessmen who are working to benefit clients in Ukraine are donating hundreds of thousands of dollars under a corporation that had been set up like a month before to benefit Donald Trump under the auspices of the group America First Action. Because America is definitely what was coming first to these individuals when they were trying to evade campaign finance laws. So let's get a little bit more information about them, because there's one more element that again draws these new scandals into the sort of meta international conversation we've been having. Parnas and Fruman, both born in the former Soviet Union and currently working in Florida's real estate market, were reportedly at the center of a plan to install a friendlier management team at the helm of Ukrainian gas company Naftogaz. So they were trying to break campaign finance laws, thus meddling in an election by channeling money to a pro-Trump super PAC. And what they were doing while they were doing that was trying to make sure that there was a more corruption-friendly management team at a Ukrainian gas company. The only thing that's not in this story is literally Hunter Biden, but all of the other deals are here. And this again, this goes back. They didn't start doing this a week ago. This whole time, since we found out everything about Ukraine and Hunter Biden and the investigation and Sondland and everything, Giuliani and Trump knew that they'd been involved in this, that these were their associates. Again, this is Giuliani's close associates. These are his fixers who were investigating Biden in Ukraine. All that time, they knew that they were actually the ones trying to make sure that more corruption was going on in Ukrainian gas companies. It is just too perfect. It's self-parody. Maybe The Onion is doing scoops for Bloomberg now. I honestly don't know. It's just too perfect. But let me give you a little bit more information. The Southern District of New York, in their indictment of Parnas and Fruman, this is one of the sort of money sections. Lev Parnas, Igor Fruman, David Herrera, Andrei Kukushnik, the defendants conspired to circumvent the federal laws against foreign interference or foreign influence by engaging in a scheme to funnel foreign money to candidates for federal and state office so that the defendants could buy potential influence with candidates, campaigns, and the candidates' governments. We already knew everything we needed for these people to go down. Now, I can't say at the end of the day that Donald Trump had personally worked with these people. I haven't seen that evidence yet. Perhaps that will come out as, you know, discovery and the court process goes on. But these were Rudy Giuliani's guys. Donald Trump sent not a diplomat, not the State Department, to Ukraine to do this sort of work of generating dirt to benefit him in the election. He sent his personal lawyer, and his personal lawyer was working with these two individuals who in the US and Ukraine were breaking the law, campaign finance, all of that to influence elections. It's too much at a certain point. It's like we have enough. We don't need more details, but more details are indeed coming in. And just because I like to occasionally touch on Rudy Giuliani's sort of reliability, fitness as a legal representative for individuals. Kenneth Vogel summed up 2 weeks in Rudy Giuliani's messaging around these two individuals by saying 2 weeks ago, Rudy Giuliani minimized the campaign finance issues facing his Ukrainian researchers, telling me, quote, I referred them to a campaign finance expert who pretty much resolved it. Yesterday, they're arrested on campaign finance charges. So I don't know how he resolved it. Maybe he reported them for breaking the law. But I can say that whether it was part of his formal advice or not, they didn't just sort of, they weren't just sitting in their office when they were suddenly taken by the Southern District of New York. No, they were stopped at Dulles International Airport as they attempted to leave the country. So they understood what they had done. They understood the legal ramifications, perhaps through conversation with their legal representatives, and they were attempting to evade justice by fleeing the United States. Thankfully, they were stopped beforehand. You can expect that this story, these stories, all of this nonsense, this big muddy ball of corruption is probably going to shed more light on what was going on, but Jesus, we already have so much. Okay, we're gonna take a short break here. Come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Let's talk now about some of the individuals and groups working to make California a more progressive state and make sure that its government is reflective of what it actually believes about politics. We're joined now by former two-term mayor of Richmond, California and current chair of California Progressive Alliance, Gail McLaughlin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. So there's a lot I want to talk about, but first I'd like to learn more about the organization, the California Progressive Alliance. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so the California Progressive Alliance is an independent statewide network of progressives who are coming together. We're individuals and we're other organizations. And the whole idea is to come together to reclaim our democracy. You know, California and our whole country is under the control of corporations. So we want to promote the voice of the people and, you know, release the corporate grip on our democracy. And there's like four main parts of our mission. First of all, we are standing for the bold progressive issues that we know need to be passed. We also support local progressive alliances in various parts of the state. We have many of them. We think that's very important to get people involved in their own area. We also support corporate-free candidates for elected office, and we wield our collective power to lobby our legislature. So we, you know, we have action teams. We have a Medicare for All action team, a single payer action team, we have a Green New Deal action team, outreach action team, and so all these things work together to really elevate us. The whole idea is to connect us all together, and we're doing a great job. And we have an upcoming convention on January 11th at UC Berkeley. So we want everybody to come to that.
Okay, very exciting. And some of the individual issue-based actions that you mentioned are some of the most high-profile policies being discussed, which feels to me, I mean, I haven't been in politics forever, but it feels to me like it's slightly different, that some of the biggest ideas being discussed are some of the most progressive ideas. And we also have some of the most high-profile politicians are incredibly progressive politicians. So I'm curious, has that made it a little bit easier over the past few years to get volunteers, to generate these alliances that you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, first of all, the California Progressive Alliance is pretty new. We had our founding convention in March of 2019 in San Luis Obispo. It kind of morphed from, I ran a lieutenant governor campaign, I've been the mayor of Richmond, so that seemed like a good step to really make it an organizing campaign to encourage people with developing their own local progressive alliances like we have in Richmond. And so we have about 15 new progressive alliances. And yes, I think people are excited about the bold new ideas that are really capturing the attention of the populace at large throughout our country. And so we have continued to promote these. After my lieutenant governor campaign, I didn't make it past the primary, but we got so many bold activists excited that we turned my campaign into the California Progressive Alliance, and we held elections for a steering committee, et cetera. So we had a great base to start with, and we're growing. And one of the things that we've really, really been able to highlight is the fact that we're stronger when we unite with one another. We're stronger when we're in solidarity with one another. And people are, get very excited about this. So we expect our next convention in January to have about 750 people. We're having Lee Camp perform at the convention. We also have invited Ralph Nader and Angela Davis, and we're hoping they accept. They haven't been confirmed yet, but Lee Camp is confirmed. We have a LGBT Latina band from Oakland called Gala Band coming. We have a spoken word artist from Richmond, Dante Clark, performing. The Sunrise Movement will be speaking, and other activists. So we have a great convention planned ahead.
So if people are interested in finding out more about the convention, how they can possibly attend, where should they go for more information?
So they should go to CaliforniaProgressiveAlliance.org, and they could sign up for the convention. It's very affordable. And also we'll be sending out affordable motels, and we have some motels that we're subsidizing, some rooms. And also all youth under 25 get in free at the convention. So all they have to do is email info@CaliforniaProgressiveAlliance.org, and I'll get them registered. Youth can also become members of the CPA for free. So we really want to promote the youth. And it'll be very diverse, but check out the website, sign up, email info@, you'll be all set to join us. And California wants to really, showcase that we used to be in the forefront of so many issues. We still are to some extent, but we have lots of challenges. So we want to really, really showcase what we can do and encourage other states to do the same.
Awesome. Well, I definitely encourage our audience to go look for more information and to attend the convention. Gail, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
We'll take a short break here. We come back, lots more.
How are you feeling?
Hell of a lot better than I did a week ago.
Well, not surprising, but that's Bernie Sanders in an updated interview where he's actually sort of saying that what we had talked about on the show yesterday about his potential change to his campaign strategy and style that'll be coming up in the near future has been sort of misconstrued. And so we're gonna get to that shortly, but I wanna give you an update on some of what Bernie Sanders is putting out there about his health, his responses to some of the controversies around his health problems, and a new attack from one of the effective political surrogates of a major Democratic primary contender against Bernie Sanders. So first of all, one of the ways that he and his campaign have been attacked over the past few days is saying that they should have, when they initially disclosed he was going to the hospital, they should have said definitively, he's had a heart attack. It is wrong of you to have not revealed that for 2 days. And so here he is responding to that.
It felt from a public perspective that there was an absence of transparency.
No, I don't accept that. No, I think that's a media thing. You know, I think that, you know, to try to understand what in fact is going on, I think we did it appropriately. We did it as quickly as we could. No apologies.
So I think that's a strong response. I mean, look, realistically, the fact that we found out he was going to the hospital inside of like 7 minutes of him actually doing it, that's just the fact that we have social media now. And before, you wouldn't have found out about any of this for 6 months or maybe until a history book was written. So yeah, we had to wait a couple of days and then we found out about it. The thing is, I consider myself an expert when it comes to medical science. I've watched every episode of House at least twice. And so I know basically how this thing goes. And it turns out that when you go into the doctor, they can't necessarily just like hook you up to a machine and it says, here's exactly what happened to you. They sort of need to run tests, they need to do stuff. It takes a little while. And I would assume that for Bernie Sanders and his wife, their initial concern was probably a little bit less making sure that like Vox knows exactly what's going on and more that they know what's going on and actually responding to it so that he doesn't like tragically die. That was probably first and foremost on their mind. I understand that people want more information. I'm generally in favor of that. But I do think that some people are harping on the disclosure because they sort of want it to be a bigger deal. That is my perception. You can agree or disagree with that. So now let's turn to the update from what we discussed on yesterday's program with J.R. Jackson. So how is he going to be campaigning going forward now that he's had this health problem dealt with? Yesterday, he had sort of implied that he'd be scaling back the number of rallies and things that he did. Some people apparently have gone too far with sort of trying to interpret what that means. And so he gave an updated quote saying, I misspoke the other day, I said a word I should not have said, and media drives me a little nuts to make a big deal about it. We're going to get back into the groove of a very vigorous campaign. I love doing rallies and I love doing town meetings. So I think, look, to some extent, this is probably, he saw that saying that, like some of even his supporters were probably a little bit disheartened by that. They want him out there as much as he has ever been. And so to some extent, this might be reassuring his supporters that he is not going to be drastically scaling back his campaign. But for those in the more like the mainstream media that are trying to turn this into a new narrative about his prospects, the direction he's going and all of that, he wants to make sure that they don't run just a little bit too far ahead of the facts in this particular bit. So here's a little bit more on the path going forward for Bernie Sanders.
People should think that I had a procedure which hundreds of thousands of people a year have. People should think that according to the doctors, I'm on the way to a full recovery.
So you will go to the debate?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
3 hours standing?
Yeah.
Did your cardiologist say?
No.
Not an issue?
Not an issue.
Yeah, so he's gonna do it. Okay, look, if he collapses during the debate, okay, then you can write a headline about it. But for now, just let the guy get back to his campaigning, okay? He's a little bit busy. But anyway, there is more to this because he wouldn't be doing all these interviews with NBC News and all that, these on the street interviews, if this hadn't become a big sort of thing in the campaign, an attempt, I think, some people to rightfully express their concern for him and his health, and for far more people, especially those working for other campaigns, to basically try to just push him out of the entire race. And so I have an example of that as well. So this is a quote coming from Representative Bobby Rush, state chair for Kamala Harris, who said, don't be so egotistical, so self-centered, that you want to put the American people and your family into that position where day by day they don't know whether you're going to have another heart attack. You don't want to do that. I'm not saying you should drop out. No, I would not say that. I'm just saying that it's pretty arrogant, self-centered, and to me, unsound for the American people to elect him president. So there's a couple of issues that I have with that. So first of all, I can't say whether or not this is sanctioned by Kamala Harris. She has obviously a lot of state chairs, a lot of people who technically are working for her organization. We will see if this is echoed by others, you know, working its way down the chain of command from Kamala Harris. So far, I haven't seen that. But to say that it's egotistical to not immediately retire from public life seems to be going a little bit far. Also, don't speak for his family, saying, I'm concerned about your family. You're not concerned about your family. You're egotistical and self-centered. That's why you're willing to put your family through hell. Okay, that's not for you to say. And what you are saying is you want him to drop out of the race. Have the courage to at least do that. He tried to evade responsibility for that by saying, I would never say that. And then pivots to something that sounds far worse, where he says, I'm just saying that it's pretty arrogant, self-centered, and to be unsound for the American people to elect him president. So he turned from Bernie's being arrogant to his supporters are all being arrogant. His supporters are all being unsound. How dare they do that to the rest of the country? Again, we haven't even been through a single primary, a single caucus. We're still really far out from that. And so this is, I guess he's allowed to be kind of unhinged and a little bit aggressive. That's the whole point of having people below you do these sorts of attacks. It's a trial balloon. See, does this get good play? Does it work out for them? And then maybe you'll see it more often. But unfortunately for them, it looks like Bernie Sanders is just gonna go back to campaigning. He's gonna be at the debate. We'll see. Maybe he'll be a really restrained Bernie Sanders. And maybe now that he's fixed his health problem, he'll actually be back to his full form. He'd been saying he'd been feeling sort of a little bit lower energy because of the apparently incipient heart attack. We can judge now ourselves to see what's gonna happen going forward. But with that, I want to turn to one of the more ridiculous pieces of the news today. This has to do with the Kurds and Donald Trump, his recent change in the policy with Turkey and Syria. So let's transition to that. Trump has been sort of flailing over the past couple of days ever since it was announced that he was going to be giving the okay to Turkey to effectively move in and wipe out the Kurds in certain parts of Syria. This is something that they had wanted to do for a very long time. They had not been able to do that for one of a couple of different reasons, either because there was a very small American military force in that region, or because one of the most important global powers hadn't yet said it's okay. You can judge for yourself which of those two it is. But here he is talking now, after days of criticism for this move, for turning our backs on the Kurds, our allies. Take a look at who he attacks when responding to those criticisms.
Now, the Kurds are fighting for their land, just so you understand. They're fighting for their land. And as somebody wrote in a very, very powerful article today, they didn't help us in the Second World War. They didn't help us with Normandy, as an example. They mentioned names of different battles. They were there, but they're there to help us with their land. And that's a different thing. In addition to that, we have spent tremendous amounts of money on helping the Kurds in terms of ammunition, in terms of weapons, in terms of money, in terms of pay. With all of that being said, we like the Kurds.
That's what I'm getting from that quote, that you really like the Kurds. You've got their backs. I can feel that. So we're gonna get back to his reference to the article, because that's another embarrassing part of this. But there's a few issues there. I love his inability to, he's supposed to be the riffer. He could just start talking. He says, we've spent a lot of money from the point of view of ammunition, weapons, and money. Generally from the point of view of money when you're talking about money. That's usually how that works. But anyway, we've already given them all this stuff. What more do they want? To not be bombed into the Stone Age? Come on, that's way too much. We already gave them guns and stuff. But the larger argument is this doofus, one of the stupidest people in American life, certainly in American public life, thinks that he's the guy to be invoking history to justify turning our backs on the people who, probably more so on an individual level than even our own soldiers, has been instrumental in the destruction of ISIS and its caliphate, the Kurds. People have been, they've had our backs for literally years. Yes, they're fighting for their own land. How dare they? How dare they want to have a state that was ripped out from under them when imperialist powers from around the world decided how they were gonna divvy up that part of the world back decades and decades ago. So, you know, shame on them for wanting their own land. But to say we can let them be bombed now because they weren't there in Normandy? I mean, that's a bizarre point to make. It's also apparently an ahistorical point to make. This is not my area of expertise. You can do your own research, but Doug Saunders says, I'm not an expert, but didn't the Kurdish Barzani revolt of 1943 help the Allies and thus the United States in Normandy and elsewhere by preventing Iraq from tilting into Axis support and reducing the need for Allied forces on this potential third front? I don't know, I'm not the person to go for that, but there is a case to be made that it's not even accurate historically. It's certainly not accurate that we should have expected the Kurds to be landing on Omaha Beach. That's absurd. And by, they would have loved to have been there, but I checked and historically, they would have loved to have taken part, but all the Kurds had bone spurs. They just couldn't show up, okay? But anyway, the idea that we should let them be killed now because they weren't there in Normandy, and And man, when those brave Ewoks were taking on the Empire in Endor, where were they then? You know, they just didn't show up. You know, when the 300 were defending the gates of Thermopylae, where were they? Where were the Kurds? This isn't how you conduct a foreign policy with these ridiculous things. But really fast, I want to jump through where he got this from, because that's even more embarrassing potentially. Trump appears, according to Will Sommer, appears to have gotten his "Kurds didn't help us at Normandy" line from a Kurt Schlichter column on Town Hall. You can see it there. He remembered the easier to pronounce parts of that. But the interesting thing about that is, so Trump is now using to support his policy quotes from Kurt Schlichter, a guy who, as early as just last year, was tweeting things like, "Any component that involves abandoning the Kurds, I am against." Or, "The Kurds stood by us. Are the Democrats going to abandon them like they did to our South Vietnamese allies?" Or, "We cannot leave the Kurds without support. That is not what America wants." So he had this view that was rock solid. Then Trump changed his mind. So Kurt Schlichter changed his mind and wrote an article that is now being used by Trump to buttress his changed mind. So it's no critical thinking in this circle. All there is a weird sort of mutual massage going on from right-wing politicians and right-wing media. I have more that I want to say. Perhaps we'll get into it tomorrow about my frustration of people sort of trying to co-opt the pro-peace message and using this to attack those who are not going to just sit by as horrific human rights abuses are perpetrated around the world. We'll try to get into that tomorrow. We unfortunately don't have the time right now. We do have to take a break. We come back, Parker Malloy is going to be joining us to break down her recent research involving PragerU. If you've been on the internet, if you've been on YouTube, you've probably come across a PragerU video. If you've been briefly drawn into Freddy Krueger's nightmare realm, you might have seen a PragerU video. But what are they actually doing? Who's behind them? What issues are they pushing for? We turn now to the expert who has apparently watched like all of them. Parker Malloy, welcome back to the show. Have you watched all of them?
It's good to be here. Not all of them, but I've watched probably 150 to 200 videos of theirs.
Okay.
It's a lot.
Okay, so look, it's obviously a right-wing media organization that is pushing for certain sorts of things. What are the important points that people need to know about PragerU?
Sure. So PragerU is they play a little fast and loose with the truth, should put it lightly. These videos, the idea is they're these 5-minute videos. They're extremely easily digestible. They have these really slick looking kind of cartoon graphics that go along with it. Well-known people narrate them. And the idea is basically to create content for conservatives to push back on liberal ideas, essentially. So you'll get a lot of anti-feminism, anti-LGBTQ stuff, anti-Muslim, climate denial stuff. Okay. My favorite little series that they sort of have is this kind of trio of videos, one from George Will, one from Kimberly Strassel, and one from David French about why donor transparency laws are bad, because it infringes on your freedom to know who spends money in politics.
Yeah, I can't imagine why they'd be biased around that. So I just want to clarify one quick thing. I have not watched 150 of their videos, but it is PragerU. So I'm correct in assuming that it's a university, right?
You would be incorrect in that assumption.
But it's in the name, Parker. I don't understand.
It is right in the name. And they own the URL, prageruniversity.com. But they are not an accredited university. However, Dennis Prager, who is the man behind the website, he had a segment on there where he argues, what really is a university? Who's to say? Who's to say what counts as a real university?
So I think the accreditation board, I think, is who's to say.
Yeah. You would think so, but yeah.
Okay, so here's what I want to get into. Now that you've watched so much of it and you've had a great write-up on Media Matters about it, this is obviously a hard right organization. They're pushing for uniformly sort of semi-deranged right-wing positions, and yet they don't yet have the sort of aura of being that sort of organization. So how have they evaded that reputation?
Sure. I mean, I think part of a big part of it is that they have a very they hide behind this sort of veneer of respectability. They have Pulitzer Prize winners who will narrate their videos. They have Emmy winners. They have professors at places like Princeton or Yale or West Point, or you know, if not professors, then faculty at these places. So they have this veneer of respectability. And what's kind of frustrating is that not all of their videos are terrible. You know, there are some videos that are fine. There's you know, the comedian Yakov Smirnoff. He did a video about why laughter is important in a relationship, and it's a fine video. Mm-hmm. There's another one about you know, the Civil War. Was the Civil War about slavery? I went into that one expecting them to go, no, states' rights. But they actually came out just saying, no, straight up, it's about slavery. Hmm. You can't make other arguments here, which was really interesting to me. But for all of those, and they have a lot of others that are just basic, like boilerplate self-help stuff, like Adam Carolla, Jordan Peterson, and NFL sideline reporter Michelle Tafoya. They all have videos that are essentially like, hey, do your best, work hard, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, which isn't necessarily harmful on its own. However, when you go from that to what Jordan Peterson's next video is, which is a video called Dangerous People Are Teaching Your Children, or something along those lines, mm-hmm. about why professors are evil and colleges are indoctrination centers, it's kind of a shock to your system. So they draw you in with these really anodyne, boring kind of videos, but they have a really hard right agenda. Yeah. And it makes sense given that Dennis Prager is behind it.
Yeah, and look, that whole self-help thing, I mean, that's Jordan Peterson's thing in his books too. He gives sort of just regular self-help stuff and then transitions you into these crazy hard right things. It's like they seem to have acknowledged there are a lot of either legitimately broken men or men who consider themselves to be broken, and they think these are people who can be radicalized. There are other sorts of organizations around the world that do that too, but we don't have time to get into it. So what I'm curious about though is I've seen numbers of the advertising budget that's spent on PragerU, which is astronomical. I know how hard it is to make money purely off of views on YouTube. And so do we have any idea who is funding this? Where are they getting all this money?
Sure. Yes, they're funded. Their startup funding rather came from the same people who fund the Daily Wire, or who funded them initially, who helped them get up and running. And so, you know, it's these two brothers who are involved in the fracking industry, which, you know, go figure that then they run a bunch of videos that are about why. Fossil fuels are so great, and why we don't have to worry about climate change. You know, these sorts of things. So it's funded by billionaires, and it has a very very obvious sort of agenda, and it's all tied together. That's why, you know, as the funding is the same between, you know, a lot of the funding does overlap between places like the Daily Wire and Prager University. You see a lot of overlap on the guests. You have Ben Shapiro showing up in Prager videos where he talks about why Western civilization is so wonderful and awesome, and why intersectionality is bad. And then you have his other sort of co-hosts or other Daily Wire personalities popping up with other videos. The best is Matt Walsh, who is kind of just a ridiculous human being. He has a video about self-esteem where he just repeatedly says, I have no self-esteem. And it's great. I highly recommend finding that one just because you get to hear him say, I have no self-esteem over and over.
Okay, well, I feel for him. And you know, I think it's Mental Health Awareness Day, I think, right now. So certainly, you know, Matt, we'll look into it. Get some help. Everybody deserves a little bit of help sometimes. Parker, you did great work. Everyone should go read your article, by the way, the sort of research that you did into PragerU. We really appreciate it, as always.
Thank you.
We're gonna take a short break here. We come back, AOC attacked for her hair after this. Right-wing media outlets often like to complain that they are not given the respect that organizations like the New York Times or the Washington Post has fought to gain over the course of literally centuries. And I have a theory as to why it is that some of them don't get that sort of respect. And to demonstrate my theory, let's take a look at an article that ran in the Washington Times. Self-declared socialist AOC splurges on high dollar hairdo. Yes, this is their big exclusive about her hairdo. So, you know, I'm gonna treat this with the respect it deserves and talk about Battlestar Galactica for a while. No, I'm kidding. I'm gonna delve into it. We're gonna take a look at their research. So, this is from their article. The New York Democrat ventured into Last Tangle Salon on 19th Street Northwest last month and shelled out $80 for a haircut and $180 for low lights, according to sources familiar with the salon. A 20% tip would have added $52 to the bill. So, they believe that she spent $300 on a haircut. And so I have never had a woman's haircut. I have lived very few days of my life as a woman. And so I turned to literally the nearest woman and asked, they hadn't seen the article. I said, blank, how much did you spend on your last haircut? And she said, 300? Like, women's hair is very expensive to cut, apparently. I can get my head buzzed for like $20 plus tip. That's not the way it goes for women, especially if they need coloring and things like that. And if you're not living out in the middle of like the Appalachian Trail in a city, it is expensive. And so feel free to comment down below if you're a woman living in a city like DC or New York or LA or any of these. Have you spent less than $100, $200, $300 on your haircut? I'm sure many of you have probably spent more. But anyway, what's interesting about this is their big exclusive. This is gonna show that this self-described socialist wants everyone else to live like homeless people, I guess, but is spending money on her haircut. So you create a straw man of what she believes and then say that she's being inconsistent with it. So they have this story and they try to get some dirt. And so it goes on. A staff member at Last Tangle Salon talked about the lawmaker as if she were a TV superstar, saying AOC was extremely nice and even took several selfies with patrons. So, like, you didn't even get the dirt that you wanted, and then they give her advice. You spent $300, AOC. Did you know that Jeff Sessions, he gets his haircut at a place where it only costs $20? And you know what he gets for that $20? A haircut that looks like it didn't cost $20. And they say she should go there instead. So what you do as a society is you set up impossible financial expectations for women. You have to look, you have to be ready to walk the Met Gala at any minute. But if you ever actually do what's required to look that way, we are gonna demonize you. If you are appearing on TV, for instance, if you're doing big events, if the cameras are on you, how dare you actually spend the money to look the way we demand you look? And she responded to this saying, won't you look at that? Mike Pence used taxpayer funds, not personal ones, to spend several thousand haircuts worth of public money on a visit to Trump golf courses. I wonder if Republicans care about corruption as much as they care about a woman's cut and color. They don't. Again, that was, she spent her money. Pence spent your money and my money and Edwin's money and everybody in the control room, your money to Trump to go visit there because he was in Ireland and he had a convenient meeting. It was only 180 miles away if he stayed there, so why not? Turns out her estimate was actually a bit low. Pence's $600K limo bill does not even cover the full cost of the trip because it excludes the cost of Secret Service detail and lodging. But what's that, like an extra grand? I'm sure it was nothing. Here's the issue. Washington Times is a joke. It is a rag. It's a digital rag. The issue isn't with the Washington Times. It's when organizations that have at least a little bit more of a reputation pick up on stuff like this, and it's already happening. New York Post, AOC's $250 hair salon trip stirs controversy. No, it didn't stir controversy. It stirred condemnation of a BS organization spreading misogynistic attacks against an elected woman of color. That's what it was doing. You're trying to make it seem like a controversy because you want the clicks too. And so I read their article. It is almost exactly the same. Each point is just said in different words, but it reads exactly the same. It barely points out that it's ridiculous. It doesn't include her response, but this is what they're doing to attack AOC, to try to discredit her, because they believe that if you are a socialist or a democratic socialist, then even though you never claim it, what you actually want for society is for everyone to walk around with like a barrel strapped over their shoulders and all their belongings in a stick and bindle. Nobody's actually saying that, but that's the fake version of socialism that they find it much more convenient to run against. And so that's how they try to discredit AOC in the pursuit of media dollars. And now you have organizations like the New York Post taking it up as well. Okay, that's unfortunately all the time we have to say. I just want to briefly say Splinter is shutting down today. It's very sad. It was an unabashed progressive news organization. It was very clear about what its perspective was. It did some great work. And unfortunately, it's a brutal environment we live in terms of media. Thank you everybody for watching today. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Derola. I'll see you soon.